Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and welcome to My Wild World. I'd like to thank Blog Talk Radio, my co-producer Eric Altman from the mountains of Pennsylvania. Had a fantastic week, and I want to thank everyone for the wonderful emails that we've been receiving in regards to our new Blog Talk Radio program. It's been fantastic. In fact, last week we had Trapper from the state of Washington on, and we were having a little problems with some of the reception because he lives basically on the foothills of the Canadian Rockies. And when the weather is a little iffy, when they get storm fronts that move through, sometimes reception isn't that great. But the majority of the program we got in, and people were quite amazed with some of his stories and encounters he'd had with the so-called legendary Bigfoot or Sasquatch. So old Trapper out in Washington, we hope to talk to him really, really soon. We had a guest lined up for tonight, folks, but I'm afraid the survivor has skipped out on us. He had promised all week long that he would be a part of our program. Rupert Bonham from the television program Survivor was supposed to be on, but I don't know what's happened. He's either flew the coop or he's gone back to the Pearl Islands in Panama. But no Rupert, and I apologize to everyone that has tuned in tonight to have an opportunity to talk to Rupert. We promoted it all week long. I cannot believe it. Talked to him all week, so apparently something's come up on his end, and he's not going to be a no-show, so I absolutely hate it. I'd like to send out a big hello to my good buddy up in Warsaw, Indiana. In fact, my wife and I, Cheryl, were out doing our school lecture programs with our animals, and already it's been quite a tremendous year. I think we've visited about 40 schools already since the 1st of October. And to give you an idea of the lineup we have this year, we have from the island of Madagascar a ringtail lemur. We're bringing along a tarantula. That's a lot of fun. Boy, you want to see the teachers squirm when we bring that tarantula out. Those are the moments. And we have this brand new, and that's kind of a funny way to put it, brand new. I should say our baby olive baboon. She weighs about 10 pounds right now. Her name is Elizabeth. And folks, I'm going to tell you right now, this is a two-legged party. It takes a lot of patience, I'll bet, to be a mother baboon, because man, this thing is so full of energy. In fact, if you email me, we just were at the Wonder Lab in Bloomington, Indiana. That's a fantastic. It's a children's museum, is actually what it is, and they have all these fabulous displays. It's in Bloomington, Indiana. We're the home of Indiana University, and this magnificent children's museum that the kids can go through there, and they've got all these experiments that they can do. It covers everything from, they have animal displays. They actually have a beautiful butterfly display where the children can actually see the complete metamorphosis process of the butterfly. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they had monarch butterflies in there. I could be wrong on that. But you get a chance to see them from the pupa, the cocoon, all through their complete cycle. And it's just a fantastic place. Well, we were there in September, and we took along our baby baboon. And I'm going to tell you, this baby Elizabeth, if you email me, I will send you a picture of this baby baboon, because I had my old friend Bob Olson. He would say, she's a hoot. She is. So my email address, if you want to get a picture of this baby Elizabeth, is lbatson, B-A-T-T-S-O-N, at peoplepc.com. And I'll be more than happy to send out that photograph for you to see. And she's been fantastic on these school programs, but I'm going to tell you right now, before we bring her out, I tell the kids, I say, hey, now this is a baby baboon, and keep in mind, in the wild, they spend almost the entire day clutched to the female baboon. I mean, wherever she goes, that baby's hanging on for dear life. And when mom walks, you know, when mom walks on all fours, she'll sit on her back, and they'll lean back against the female's tail. But they're constant energy. And of course, the male baboon, he absolutely has nothing to do with raising the babies, per se. I mean, if they act annoyed when the babies come around, the male baboon just sort of pushes them away. But the females, of course, they're very involved. And I think that's the reason this little baboon has a tail, because it gives the female baboon an extra handle to grab a hold and pull her back. And she's something else. But of course, in the wild, now I'm going to tell you something. If you've been watching the National Geographic or Animal Planet, and you've seen any of these things, these specials on baboons, pound for pound, they are probably one of the toughest, one of the most ferocious animals you'll ever see. There's that old story. In fact, I remember reading about this in Life magazine, where a leopard was sneaking up on this baboon troop. There was probably 25 or 30 baboons in this troop. Of course, the dominant male. Now, he'll weigh, well, they can go 80 to 100 pounds, maybe a little bit more. But you talk about strong. You cannot even imagine the strength that a male adult baboon has. Then inside of their mouth, they have these 3-inch razor-sharp canine teeth that are basically like having 4 daggers inside of their mouth. And this male baboon, he is serious all the time. And all day long, while the other baboons are foraging and looking for food, well, he's looking for food as well, but he's always looking around because he realizes the danger of leopards, lions, hyenas. And what happened on this particular incident, in fact, this was actually witnessed by a photographer, and I believe he worked for Life magazine. And he was watching this leopard move in closer and closer to this baboon troop. Well, the baboons, you know, at first they didn't realize it because the wind was blowing the wrong direction, and they couldn't pick up that leopard scent. And, of course, the leopard in that tall yellow grass, they're practically invisible. I mean, they are. I mean, you could walk right by it and never see this cat that weighs 125 to 175 pounds. And it's getting closer and closer to this baboon troop. And it waited for just the right moment that it felt that the larger baboons were not paying attention. And it charged into that troop of baboons and it grabbed one of those babies. Well, as soon as it touched that baby, this baby let out a scream, which I'm going to tell you right now. No bigger than they are, that scream is unbelievable. I mean, the volume that these little primates can acquire, cannot even describe. So, it lets out a scream. The other baboons immediately turn around, and they see what has happened. And all of the adult baboons attacked that leopard. When they had finished, there was not a piece of that leopard left the size of your hand. I mean, it is incredible. In fact, I had a friend many years ago that had an assignment. He worked. I can't remember what company he worked for, but his job was to go in and capture several animals alive from Africa. They captured Cape Buffalo. They captured lions, leopards, hyenas, wildebeest or gnus, several of the antelope species. But he told me, he looked me right in the eye, and he said, Larry, he says, I'm going to tell you something right now. The baboons, when they would run into that net, he said, it was like an eruption. He says, the power, the screams, he said, I had no idea how ferocious these baboons can be. We had a baboon that had been a part of our program for 25 years. In fact, this was a Hamadryas baboon. These baboons come from Egypt and North Africa. They're found in the pyramid lands. In fact, the Egyptians used to actually worship these baboons because they admired them, because baboons are basically devoted to their families. I mean, a male baboon would sacrifice his own life to protect one member of his family or his troop. And they would worship these baboons. Well, we had this baboon that we had raised for 25 years, and the intelligence is absolutely incredible. But I'll tell you something, folks. This baboon became totally devoted to my wife Cheryl and I, and if anybody looked at us wrong, they had to take it up with the baboon. Because she was something else. I mean, she was absolutely, she has the wild instinct. They're absolutely fearless. I mean, when it comes to protecting their family, nothing comes between them. And there was a soldier who was fighting a war in Africa. And while they were in combat, they found a mother baboon that had been killed and clutched to her body was her baby, which was still alive. So one of the soldiers said, I'm going to adopt that baby baboon. So the other soldiers said, that's a terrible idea, because not only do we have to fight in this war, this conflict, but now we've got to babysit this baby baboon. He said, well, don't you worry about it. He said, I'll take care of the baby baboon. Well, I'm going to tell you something. That baby baboon became totally devoted to that soldier. And it ended up being a savior. Because they would go through areas that they'd had to worry about snipers. And when they'd walk into these areas, the baboon, by using his sense of smell, hearing, and eyesight, he knew when there was someone hiding in the rainforest in the jungles of Africa. And he would warn those soldiers. He would let out a scream that told them, danger. Saved their lives many times. Once, though, that soldier wasn't quite so lucky. A mortar landed very close to him, and he was severely injured. I mean, his leg was just cut to ribbons. But that baboon stayed right by his side, licked his wounds, and prevented any infection, and basically saved his legs as well as his life. In fact, after the conflict was over, the baboon and the soldier returned home. That baboon was given a rank. He was also given a medal. And he was actually a part of a parade that welcomed those soldiers back. And if you don't believe me about that story, it's absolutely true. It's in the Guinness Book of World Records. And it's quite amazing. And every time I would look at our baboon, our Hamadryas baboon, I'd always think about that. And I tell you what, there's something about when you look in a primate's eyes, there's a lot of wisdom there. I mean, they're basically telling you, I may not really be able to talk to you, but I can communicate very, very well. And they do it with their eyes. They do it with their mannerisms. Now, this baby baboon, when it wants its bottle of milk, it has a very special scream, a bark. And here's what's funny is she wants that bottle of milk sometimes in the middle of the night. And there's no set time. But we have her in our bedroom because, you know, she's a baby baboon. We have to watch her all the time. So we have her in the bedroom, and if she hears me get out of bed in the middle of the night, I got this little squeak on my side of the mattress that when she hears that, I can hear her rumbling around. Then they make this sound. My wife calls it a humming sound. And it tells me one thing. Go fix it a bottle of milk. And it drinks Enfamil, the same thing that we feed the human babies. Enfamil with iron, that's right. And I'll go in and make her a bottle of milk, and she'll drink about 8 ounces, and she's fine. She goes right back to bed, goes right back to sleep. It works perfectly. And right now she's eating a variety of fruit, vegetables. But I'm going to tell you, she's something else. In fact, we took her on television. There's a local station here in Indianapolis. It's a CBS affiliate. And we took her on there one day. And one of the reporters that always interviews me, his name's David Barish. Well, he's a little frightened of animals. People will ask me, is he as afraid of the animals as he seems to be on TV? I says, oh, no. I says, on TV, he's actually acting very well. He is totally, totally terrified of these animals. So we take this baby baboon on, and the baby baboon comes out there, and it's just nuts. I mean, it does flips. It runs up on top of my head. It hangs by my hair. It laughs. You heard me right. It makes a laughing sound. It sounds very human-like. In fact, it's almost scary. And it's laughing. It's carrying on. And, of course, it wears its diaper. And, you know, a baboon has a tail, so you have to customize the diaper. And it's running around. And baboons are smart, like most animals. And it could look at this fella and see that he was totally terrified of this 10-pound baboon. So we're sitting there, and I'm explaining about it's from Uganda, and they not only live in the drier regions, but they also will go into the forest. Most baboons kind of stay out in the open. Night, they'll actually sleep in the trees, and I explained how the female baboons will get 30 to 40 pounds, the males will go 70 to 80 pounds, and They're quite ferocious, quite fearsome. And this little baboon's looking at him, and she's got him pegged. She knows that he's so frightened of her. So she's basically doing a mock charge, where she's charging him. And he's like, he's almost curled up in a ball on the couch in a fetal position. And I say to him, I go, that baboon, I go, she smells fear. And he says, and I want to put this on a T-shirt. It's a fantastic quote. He goes, I stink of fear. It was phenomenal. Excuse me. I don't know what's going to kill me first, talking about the baboon or this darn whatever the kids have given me the last couple of weeks. But, yes, it was pretty funny. But we're having a fabulous school year, and it's been wonderful. And also, we've been taking along, you know, my wife, God bless her. We're raising a bobcat, and we have this baby bobcat that we started when it was 2 weeks old. And when we first adopted it, it didn't even have its eyes open yet. In fact, we had it, I think, for maybe a day before it did. And we did that for a reason, because we wanted that bobcat. The first thing that it would ever see was either my wife, Cheryl, or myself. Because especially with this animal, it was very important that we had its total trust. And we raised it from the very beginning. Because I'm going to tell you something, and I know most of the guys out there and girls that spend any time in the outdoors that are familiar with fauna of North America, that pound for pound, the bobcat is probably one of the most how should I put this? I don't really want to say ferocious, but pound for pound, maybe one of the toughest animals we have in North America. I mean, a 500-pound black bear, they run into one, they're not messing with it. 200, 250-pound mountain lion or cougar, puma, they run into a bobcat, they go the opposite direction. They know that it's going to fight. You know, it's almost like it has the little man complex. But they're just so darn tough. So she's been raising this bobcat, and she's done this fantastic job because I've raised them before. And I'll tell you, when they get a certain age, you know, sometimes that's true with a lot of different animals that we work with. You know, right off the top of my head, I can think of baby raccoons that we've raised. It seems like when they get about a year old, something happens that they, I don't want to say they return to the wild, they become what they are. And that's what we've had with bobcats. In fact, I can still remember a fellow that worked for me, the last bobcat we had. He was supposed to bring the bobcat out of our animal truck, the truck that we transport the animals to the schools in. And he's in the truck. We've got this great big enclosure for this bobcat that was probably, I'm remembering, he was about 10 or 11 months old. He weighed probably 30 pounds. So I'm outside of the truck, and I'm listening. And, oh, my God, I hear this scream, growl, this really wildcat sound. And then I hear him say something that I won't say on the show. And basically, this 30-pound bobcat had this 250-pound guy backed into the corner. And he wouldn't let him out. It wasn't happening. Every time he moved, that bobcat would leap into the air, and all he would see are claws and teeth. I think finally I had to go in and rescue him because I had a little bit better relationship with the bobcat than he did. But that, you know, that's the way that they are. So my wife, she's done this amazing job with this young bobcat. I mean, all summer long she was up at 5:30, 6 in the morning when she's here. Oh, by the way, we named him Gus. And you should see Gus. If you send me a note to my email, I'll send you a photograph of him. And my email again is lbatson, B-A-T-T-S-O-N, at peoplepc.com. But she's done this fantastic job, and every morning she'd get up, she says, oh, I hope he does well, I hope he does well. Well, let me explain something. Today we were in Warsaw, Indiana. We were at two elementary schools. The first one, it's Harrison Elementary School, and the principal there, his name is Randy Polston. And this year, they have almost 800 elementary students. I mean, the building is full. In fact, next year they're going to open up a couple new schools. So we had a big crowd in this gymnasium. And these are kindergarten through, I think, fifth, maybe sixth grade as well. Big group of kids. And my wife, she brings out the bobcat. Of course, what I'll tell these children before they come out, I'll say, now, this is a bobcat. If you've hiked, camped, or fished in any state forest here in Indiana, more than likely, when you were on that adventure, that you were being watched by an animal, but you just didn't know it. He'd be way up in a tree. That's what bobcats will do. They'll climb up into a tree, they'll find a nice strong limb, and they can stretch out on that limb or branch, and up there they can catch a cool breeze, and at the same time, they are perfectly hidden. So here's Cheryl walks in with a bobcat, and I've got 800 kids, and they're not making a sound, folks. I mean, they're absolutely quiet. Their hands are in their laps. You could hear a pin drop in that room. And she carries the bobcat in. She sets him on a table, and he's looking at these 800 kids, and he's just totally comfortable. I mean, that, I think that is the key. You know, a lot of people, I have never, ever recommended or said to anyone, wild animals are pets, because they're not. They're wild animals. But these animals that we take to, gosh, I don't know, 200 schools a year, these are ambassadors for the animals that live in the wild. When these children are sitting in those bleachers, or they're sitting on the gym floor watching our program, it's a whole lot different when they're sitting in front of a computer monitor and everything they're seeing is a flat screen. And for these young people to really care about our natural world, they have to see these things in person. Not every one of these kids can go to places such as Yellowstone National Park, Glacier National Park, Rocky Mountain National Park. It's not happening. It would be great if they could, but a lot of kids are just not that lucky and able to do that. Might be able to go to a zoo, but you'd be surprised that a lot of kids don't even get that opportunity. But when you walk into that school, and especially some of the schools that we do, you look at the kids and you realize these kids don't have a lot. These kids live in a community that they don't get out too much. And they get so excited, so thrilled to see these animals. And what I really believe is that when these kids grow up, they are our future. And they're going to be making decisions on whether we need to have the proper funds to keep the roads open in places like Yellowstone National Park. I mean, that's a big concern nowadays. The government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Department of the Interior, they're just concerned on whether we have enough money to keep open and properly maintain our national parks. And that's a crime. Because we need these areas. We need these places where people can go and have a chance to, well, for me, it's Rocky Mountain National Park. Every summer are my parents. And now that I'm grown up and I remember those days, I look back and I thought, you know, I enjoyed it at the time, but I don't think I really appreciated those moments. Fresh mountain air, the opportunity to, of course, be with your family, but to hike through these mountains and see these amazing things Mother Nature's put on this planet. So for these young people, when we're doing our program, to see these animals sitting on a table in their gymnasium, I get the emails. They email me through our website, and they tell me how much it means to them. And I know something. I know that all these 800 kids that we saw today, they're not going to grow up and be zoologists. They're necessarily not going to all grow up and be biologists. They're not going to grow up and be the guy that is crazy enough to take wild animals into schools. No. But what they're going to grow up and do is they're going to be voters. They're going to be the people that are going to decide whether we have enough money to maintain our national parks. They're the people that's going to grow up and they're going to decide whether we need to save animals like the Florida panther, the North American bobcat, prime example. In Indiana at one time, where I'm from, they're almost extinct. They made it illegal to kill them, to hunt them. They've come back now. In fact, right here in my own property, my own home here in Clinton Falls, I've seen bobcats. In fact, when my wife and I were on our honeymoon many years ago, how many years ago was that? Oh, I'm in so much trouble if I don't remember. 18 years ago. We were in Rocky Mountain National Park, and we're driving across Trail Ridge Road. That's the only continuous, well, I should say it's the highest continuous highway in the United States. And it's just about dark, and we're almost to the tundra. We're still in the forest. And I look to the right side of the road, and I see a gray blur. And it slows down enough as it runs across in front of our car that finally by the middle of the road, I could see what we were watching. And it was a bobcat. And then it was gone. I mean, it made its way across that road in about Oh, gosh. 3 or 4 seconds, it seemed like. Just a glimpse. But I told Cheryl, I said, you know what? I said, we're very, very lucky. Because there are people that have spent or lived their entire lives in these mountains and have never, ever had a chance to see a bobcat in the wild. Very lucky. So hopefully, when we visit our schools and the different programs that we do, that these young people that have a chance to see a ringtail lemur from Madagascar or a olive baboon from Uganda or even a simple tarantula from the jungles of Central America or a python, Burmese python from Burma, Asia, or a bobcat, that they'll understand these animals, appreciate them, and realize why we need to have them on this planet. We need them in our wild world. It's very, very important. We're going to take a break. We'll be back. We have a call-in number. I'd like to talk to some of our listeners and shoot the breeze. The number, if you'd like to call in, to Blog Talk Radio, Larry Batson's Wild World, is 1-347-855-8123. We'll talk about whatever you'd like to talk about. But we're going to take a short break. We'll be back. We have some PSAs. That's public service announcement. And we'll be right back on Blog Talk Radio with Larry Batson's Wild World.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at takemefishing.org.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of Rad. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. Remember, if you're partying this holiday season, don't drink and drive. Got it? It's just not worth it. Doesn't make sense. Thank you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Duty, freedom, country, family. They're the values that make America strong and what our armed forces are fighting to defend.
While many talk about these ideals without action, they are just empty words.
If you think America's military families deserve more, log on to thanksusa.org. It's a great way to thank our troops and give military families the gift of education.
thanksusa.org. Scholarships for America's military families. You can make a difference.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting?
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, 1 second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
There are some visitors you'd just rather not see. Like your obnoxious brother-in-law, Louie.
Hey, everybody, we're here! Good to see you! When do we eat?
But then there are some visitors you just can't get enough of. to make your farm or ranch a more attractive place for the visitors you actually want to see, contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office. They can help you build the habitat wildlife loves. But as for Louie, try disconnecting the doorbell. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everybody, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson. Welcome to my wild world. We promoted it all week, and boy, did we have a big letdown tonight. We had the survivor, Rupert. In fact, I've known Rupert for a while. That's right. He's a, how should I put this? He likes to keep reptiles. I think he has a couple pythons, and he has an alligator he's raised. Well, we have what we, here in Indiana, what is called a reptile show, or like a swap meet, or several vendors. We have it at the state fairgrounds in Indianapolis, and several vendors will come in, set up booths, and let's put it this way. This is not the type of event you'd want to attend if you're a little apprehensive of snakes, lizards, or tarantulas, or various other cold-blooded creatures, because there's, how should I put it, there's buckets of them. Oh, my gosh. You name it, you can buy it. Pythons, snakes, tortoises, African frogs. I'll tell you what, African frogs, I should finish my thought. I'll tell you what, one of the wildest things that I saw at the show, though. In fact, I went with my good friend, Henry Day. And it's on a Sunday. And it's always great because my team, the Indianapolis Colts, didn't have to play until later, so we could attend the event and watch the Colts game later. But they had for sale, and I'd never seen this before, and I thought I was pretty attuned to animals per se. But they had what they called naked guinea pigs. Guinea pigs that did not have a hair on their body. And they were, how should I put this? They were disturbing. They were very, very, they looked like, they were very strange. Yes, very strange. They looked like miniature pigs. Pigs that were about 8 inches long. That's right. And we stood there. For the longest time and looked at those naked guinea pigs. And I thought to myself, I didn't even ask what the person wanted for them, because I would have, I don't know what I would have done with it. It's nothing I could, well, I could guess I could use it. I know I could use it in a lecture as a naked guinea pig. It looked like a little miniature pig. In fact, I had this friend in the Everglades, and his name was Ron DuPont. We were buds. I mean, he basically raised 10 kids by capturing and collecting snakes and other reptiles from Florida, and he would ship them all over the world. You heard me right. He'd go out and catch snakes and lizards and turtles, and he would ship them to Europe. He sent me a lot of them, I'll tell you right now. For many years, he would send me shipment. It was always such a blast to get these boxes of reptiles from Ron, because it was, for me, it was like Christmas morning. He'd come in on the airplane, and he was so meticulous the way he'd pack them. I mean, I never had anything arrive that the health wasn't just tremendous. I can't always say that in the olden days when you'd get various animals from animal dealers in Florida, but Ron, he was special, because basically these were all specimens that he went out and collected in the wild, and it was always quite special to get them. Well, I told him, he lived in West Palm, and I said, one of these days I'm going to get down there, and we're going to go snake collecting, because he was a master snake hunter. He had these 10 kids, and the kids would go out and collect snakes too. And they'd be in their house, and they lived right on the edge of the swamp. And he could hear, he could listen to the birds. He could listen to the birds, and by a sound like a crow would make, it told him that a snake was in the vicinity of that crow. So there would be the kids. They'd be sitting there in the living room. All of a sudden, old Ron, Dad, would hear this wild, wacky sound this crow was making. And he was even, he would even tell me, which I don't know if he was feeding me a line or not, but he would tell me that he could tell by the sound of that crow what type and what size a snake was trying to eat the crow's babies out of the nest or was just lurking in the vicinity. And he'd hear that sound, those kids would fly out the front door, and in about 10 or 20 minutes they'd come back with a 6 or 7 foot yellow rat snake that they'd caught in the vicinity of this crow. He was a trip. And he'd always go snake collecting. He had one of these old Volkswagen buses, but he had no doors on it because what you would do is, when you go snake hunting in Florida, like many places, you don't necessarily, the best place to look is not in the swamp, in the woods. It's along the roads, because once the sun goes down, the asphalt retains a lot of heat, and these snakes will basically crawl out into the road, and you'll cruise up and down the road, and that's how you catch them. Well, he told me, he says he had this one road that he would always travel in his bus that was next to a canal. Of course, in Florida, they've got these canals that, well, that's why the Everglades was almost destroyed, because of these canals. But they're great habitats for snakes, and you cruise up and down these roads next to these canals. And the different species of snakes that we would find, they'd be moving across this road by this canal at a certain time of day, and you would go by barometric pressure and just basically the environment. And we'd be going down the road, and he'd be driving 25 or 30 miles an hour, and it was dark. You'd spot the snakes in the headlights, and he was good. I mean, you know, it's pretty good when you just see the shape of a snake underneath the headlight, and you really can't, and he can tell you right away. He said, oh, yellow rat snake on the right, looks like about a four-footer, scarlet king snake, corn snake, eastern diamondback rattlesnake. Yeah, but there'd be different parts of the road where you'd find and you would catch different species of snakes. So I'm down there with Ron, and we're going snake hunting, and we're cruising up and down this road in this Volkswagen bus, and he'd tell me, he says, now, he said, these snakes will, they'll only be moving for like 20 minutes. So we've got to get down this road quick and grab them and put them in the bag and then keep going down the road. So we're going down the road, and he'd say, yellow rat snake, and I'd hop out of that bus, and I'd grab that snake, and I'd have it in the bag quick, back in the bus where we're going. So we'd caught several snakes. We'd caught yellow rats. We'd caught red rats or corn snakes. So we see this one snake, and he says, Florida water snake. So I jump out of this bus, this Volkswagen bus, and I'm running toward this snake, and I'm getting ready to grab it. And just as I'm getting ready to grab this snake, you know that little voice that talks to you sometimes? The one that says, maybe you ought to think this situation over twice. Well, I'm getting ready to grab this snake, and I'm looking at the silhouette of it. And I say to Ron, I say, Ron, let's hit this one with a flashlight. Let's get some light on this one. So he kind of grumbles, and one guy from Indiana trying to tell me what I'm doing, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I'm getting ready to grab this snake, and he shines a light on it, and I am really, really glad that he did, because it was a Florida pygmy rattlesnake. They have very toxic venom. They're not very big. you probably would not die from the bite, but you may have wished that you did.
Hey, Larry?
Yeah.
We got a call if you're interested.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to go to the switchboard here and bring on this person from the 765 area code.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Larry. It's Linda. Dr.
Hi, Linda.
Onion. I
Hi,
have
Doc.
Pneumonia, so bear with me. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Linda. How are you?
I've been better. I have a question for you about my snake, Henry. You know Henry. You've seen pictures.
Yeah.
I fed him yesterday, and when I reached in to get him, I think it's because of my antibiotics. I smell funny. He went at me like he was going to bite me, so I just dropped him.
Remind
and he starts,
me what kind of snake you have.
He's a corn snake. He's
okay,
about 4 feet long.
Okay.
And he starts rattling his tail like a rattlesnake.
Maybe
and he has never done that before. I've never seen that. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I thought, he's telling me something.
Well,
leave him alone.
Have you fed him recently?
Well, that's what I was. He was a couple days late. I had fed him.
Go ahead.
Like 9 days ago.
Well, 2 days makes no difference. Do you have a cat?
Three.
You have three cats?
Yes.
Were you petting your cat before you went in and handled your snake? Or attempting to handle your snake?
Possibly.
That would do it. That would do it in a minute, I'll tell you, because people don't understand, but the snakes don't see that well. They see light and they see shadows. That's basically, they do not see as we see. And their entire life is basically controlled by their tongue. They taste the air with their tongue. This is how they find food. So my guess, it wasn't the antibiotics, but maybe just simply petting the cat, and that would do it. I'll tell you what to do if that ever happens again, is what, and I've done this when handling big pythons, because I'll tell you what, you get bit by a big python, it hurts.
I'm sure.
But I'll take like maybe like a...
I've held your python, and it's quite heavy.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, Linda, I had a couple reticulated pythons.
Oh, God, no, thank you.
The two of them I had were about 18 feet long. These are snakes that weighed well over 200 pounds. And I got bitten by them one time. Basically what happens is you get bit, the tooth goes in one part of your finger and comes out the other.
Yeah.
That's a festival. But I'll take a piece of paper when I go in with them, and I'll just kind of either lay it on top of their head or just simply not hit them, but tap to let them know, hey, we're not bringing in a rat right now or a rabbit. So everything's, cool. And so basically what I do, if it acts like that again, is I just take a towel or something, lay it over, then pick it up. And once it realizes that dinner's not on its way, it'll be fine. But I bet you that's exactly what happened, is that it picked up the scent of your cat. And, because a snake like that can go a long time without eating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had them go sometimes as long as almost a year without eating.
Really?
Especially wild caught ones. And they don't, what's interesting is they don't, you go to your pet shop and you get you a white mouse. Well, they've never seen a white mouse before. So that's a whole new ball game for them. So it takes them a while to adapt to it. And, even the laboratory mice smell different than the wild mice do. So it's kind of wild. In fact, we even had snakes that I used to get in the olden days, Eastern Diamondback rattlesnakes I used for lectures. And I'd have to have a particular time that I would feed them. And I'd always feed them like at dusk. And you'd have to put them in a hiding box where they could only see people or smell people if they wanted to. In other words, they had to climb out of that box on their own. And, it got so it was quite a science that many times to get these snakes to eat like that. So are you going to feel well enough? Because, I have a big Bigfoot lecture in Newcastle.
Well, I'm going to try to come on. Yeah, I'm going to try to make it. I am feeling quite a bit much better, but now I feel like I've got a knife through my lung, so I'm wondering if I'm getting a little pleurisy with it, too. Pleurisy and I have had many bouts, and it's not fun. I got Henry at the snake show in Indy that you were talking about.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll tell you, that's a wild event, isn't it?
It is. There are buckets of snakes there.
There are buckets of snakes. And I was there last month, and there wasn't quite the assortment that there normally is, but even still, there were pounds and pounds of animals.
They had some really weird snakes the last time I was there, and they had them in, what looked like containers that you would get your potato salad in at Walmart.
Uh-huh.
And these... Or they looked like they had an arrow-shaped head. They're bright green, and they were real thin. And they had themselves in, a hoop shape, and they were rigid up and down inside that container. It was the weirdest thing I've seen.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and a lot of people used to say, does that snake like being in that small aquarium? Well, think about where you find them in the wild. You find them crammed underneath a rock or a log. They feel more comfortable in their confined areas. And we used to use old plastic shoe boxes, and we'd house snakes. So there was a time I used to breed a lot of snakes, corn snakes and yellow rats and king snakes. And we have this racks of shoe boxes with snakes in there with their eggs, and they did great. I mean, there's no problem whatsoever. I mean, snakes basically spend 80% of their life in a circle coiled up waiting for the next meal. That's why they can go weeks and weeks and months without food.
I took Henry to Ball State with me before I got sick. It was, I think, last Wednesday I took him to school with me.
So how did that go over?
Well, I kept him hidden in a under a cloth sack on my desk unless somebody wanted to see him, and then I would get him out because I didn't know if I'd get in trouble.
Right.
And I didn't know if people would freak out if they saw me walking in with a snake.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's...
I kept
him in the bag. Well, people usually don't... Even if my wife is... she's not really a snake fan. And she's all right with it if she knows where the snake is at. But, we had... I'd just come back from Washington, and I'd driven all night. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. And all of a sudden, I hear my wife, Cheryl, she just starts screaming.
Oh,
poor Doc Onion. She's doing rough, folks. Her prayers are for her.
Sorry.
That's quite all right. God love you. And so I get up out of bed, and she's screaming and dancing in the yard, and there's a pair of black rat snakes in our primate building, and they were basically making snake love. They got me doing it.
I'm sorry.
I think I'm going to die now here too. They were raptured in love. And of course,
wow.
I was going, unbelievable, I've never seen anything like that before right here, and blah, blah. And of course, she says, well, I'm glad, because it just scared the whiting out of me. But, so that's, people, when they're not aware of, even myself, and I have strong respect for snakes. But I can still remember the very first rattlesnake I caught in southern Indiana when I caught that snake. And I wasn't even looking for the rattlesnakes. I was looking for something else. And then for the rest of the day, every step I took in the woods of Brown County, I'd be looking around thinking, oh, God, they're everywhere. But, that was funny. Well, you don't feed your snake live food, do you?
I tried to once. We bought a mouse at Night Stalkers in Anderson, and we stopped at Walmart on the way home, and just in there for a minute, and I said to Jerry, I said, what if that mouse gets out in the car? And he says, oh, it won't. So I open the door, and I get in and sit down, and I look up, and there's that mouse sitting there looking at me, and I'm like, oh, crap. So I grab my cane, and I bash it, and it retreats up to the windshield, and I bash it again, and then it runs over behind the box, and I put on my leather mitten, and I grab it, and I put it in the case, and it flips around, and I close up the little box, and then I peek in, and I've killed the mouse.
Yeah. Well, the snake would still have eaten it. Did it?
Oh, he did. He loved it.
Well, I always...
It was fresh.
Well, you know, when you go to the reptile shows, now dig this, folks. They actually have booths where you can buy different sizes of frozen mice and rats. Am I not right?
You are. It's actually cheaper that way. I get 50 medium-sized mice for $36 instead of paying roughly $2 a piece for them in the pet shop.
Oh, yeah. So you can buy the frozen mice. They're packed like hot dogs. You can put them right there in the freezer next to the broccoli.
Exactly. And if somebody comes over that, you know, you want to play a good joke on them, tell them you're running low on food, and then you get out the mice.
That's right. Yeah, and we just put them in the microwave for about 30 seconds, and you have tasty treat while you watch the Colts game.
We're a little short on food. Let's have mice tonight.
Yeah.
But it always gets quite the reaction.
But people don't believe me, but I've actually had mice, and this is, well, you know, 34 years ago when I first started doing this sort of thing, that the mice would actually attack and kill the snake. And they also carry TB, so the mouse bites the snake while the snake is attempting to kill it, and then weeks later, all of a sudden one day, the snake dies, and you don't understand why, and it's because of some problem or disease that's caught for the mouse that was originally its food. Because in the wild, most people don't realize that snakes are scavengers, and they catch a lot of live mice, but you know, they catch a lot of mice that, like newborns and things, which are basically helpless. So, and they're not the tremendous hunters people believe that they are. That's why they are able to and can go without food for a long time. It doesn't affect them. Because if they were master hunters, well, we'd have 20-foot snakes living in Indiana. But that's not going to happen.
I don't want to think about that.
No. So I've got the Bigfoot program at the Newcastle Library at the 2 o'clock this Saturday. So anyone that's listening that is close to Newcastle, and that's on the eastern part of Indiana, come on over. I'll give about a two-hour lecture, and I'll have CDs and DVDs to buy and stuff. And Linda, gosh, I hope you feel better. I hope you can make it over.
I'm going to try. It's only like 5 miles.
Oh, there you go. Well, heck, bring your ventilator.
There you go. Hey, well, I looked out the bathroom window the other day and saw three coyotes.
Well, there you go. Look how wild Newcastle's become. That's outstanding.
Oh, there you go.
Well,
guys, we got about a minute left.
We got about a minute left. We're sorry, folks, for the ones that tuned in to listen to Rupert, but Rupert was a no-show, and I don't know why. He's really let me down. But, hey, we've got some exciting things coming up. I promise you, next week we're going to have a couple of very special Bigfoot eyewitnesses. Joan Embry from the San Diego Zoo, Jim Fowler from the Old Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, and also the world's greatest escape artist, Bill Shirk, is going to be on our program coming up. So we'll send out the emails. We'll let everybody know. This is Larry Batson. We'd like to thank Blog Talk Radio. We'd like to thank Wildlife Educational Services, Eric Altman, co-producer. And thanks for hanging out right here in my wild world. Have a great week, everybody. We'll be here next Thursday.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.